Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Rose Tremaine. We're here at Downing College in Cambridge. We're the guests of the British Council, and we're at the Symposium on the Contemporary British Novel. And so what you hear are the circumambient sounds of a college dorm room. Rose Tremaine is the author most recently of The Way I Found Her. It's being published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Her previous books include Sacred Country, Restoration, The Garden of the Villa Molini and Other Stories, The Swimming Pool Season, The Colonel's Daughter and Other Stories, and I'm just speaking of those that I know to have been published in America. Now, The Way I Found Her is one of my favorite kinds of books, and so I'm speaking entirely as a partisan here and a recommender of this book. There are certain books for me that induce enchantment, and many of them are set in the perilous territory of adolescence. These include Le Grand Monde by Alain Fournier, Catcher in the Rye, of course, Elizabeth Bowen's The Death of the Heart, and certain writers seem to understand that adolescence, with its possibilities of transformation of every kind, sexual, emotional, is a terror zone where romance and fear and the undiscovered meaning of everything rival for attention. And so it is for the narrator of this book, Lewis Little. Now, innocence in your work always seems to be threatened. And in fact, I would say my version from my reading of your work is that it's the relationship of innocence to terror. It's almost as if hopefulness opens possibility, and possibility, which floods in afterwards, is as likely to be malign as it is positive, which leans to a certain tone of madness in the work. Was it a temptation to bring Lewis, who is, throughout the book one discovers, a heroic little boy and very brave and bright, was it a temptation to ruin him more?
To ruin him in what sense? To ruin him, to destroy him more,
yes.
Do you mean? To so that the consequences of the ending are more desperate than they are?
Yes, and to let the implications of his ongoing experience be more threatening to him than they are.
Mm. I don't know if the temptation was there. I think the thing which happens to me when I'm writing a novel, and which I have come to view as, in fact, being very important to the writerly craft, if it's going to solicit the sympathy of the reader, is that the writer be attached emotionally or in some fundamental way to the central character. I'm made very anxious by writers who condescend to their characters, which I think in parentheses is one of the reasons why I favor a first-person narration, that I become the character, because if you are inside the head of the character, you can't condescend to them. You have to be them. You have to live what they live. So you can't sort of look at them, you know, from high down to low. So that I think by that token, I have a tendency to treat my central characters, if you like, in a way that I would wish to treat friends or lovers or people I feel deeply attached to. But I also wish them to learn. And I think that the kind of learning that Lewis goes through, just as characters in my other novels have gone through periods of learning, in that period of learning, for however long it takes, there is pain and there is suffering, which may get quite acute.
Well, what I noticed in this book, which is The Way I Found Her, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, by my guest Rose Tremaine, what I noticed in this book is that virtually every character is following someone. Lewis is looking for eventually Valentina, but even before she is missing, he has fallen in love with her, so he's desiring something from her. The mother, Alice, may be out with Didier, who seems also to have a wife. The Valentina is seeing a former lover and is being pursued by a former husband. Hugh, back in London, the representative of home, is deciding not to follow Alice. There seems to be a set of trails, almost as if everyone is on seeking, you know, someone else, with the possibility that what will be learned will be painful.
The character in Restoration, which is, I guess, the book of mine that's best known in the States, the character, this is all set in 17th century London, and the character is a physician who kind of loses track of his vocation, loses track of his heart. And he has this image about Charles II, the Stuart King, as being like a kind of a moving light. And that not only he, but everybody in England at the time of the Restoration indeed, was kind of mesmerized by this moving light, and they couldn't take their eyes off it. And because they couldn't take their eyes off it, what was going on around them, what was going on at their feet, if you like, was potentially very dangerous and very bad. And I think that there's an element of that that happens in this narrative, that everybody has their eyes on a moving light, and they are mesmerized by this particular thing, Louis by Valentina, Alice by Didier. Valentina herself is in quest of things which we learn in the end are not going to be realistic for her. And then there is, of course, the more threatening characters who are in pursuing her. So there are these complex lines of pursuit. Anyway, that was one idea I had about it, about the characters sort of being mesmerized by the thing which may or may not be unobtainable. Probably will be, but may not necessarily be.
What fascinated me was that if they do not go on their quest, but stay with their project, which in most cases is a literary project, they will be safe. So it's almost as if these people have the option of being questers and exposing themselves to risk, or being writers and allowing the risk to occur on the page. And so although Hugh has, his project is building a home, which makes sense. He's the nest builder, and there are storks.
Yes, which is a reversal of the normal role.
Yes. Alice has her translation to do, Valentina her novel to write, but she is perhaps about to be a plagiarist, and so she may be even throwing risk into her literary work. Lewis has his notebook that he's gotten on the airplane that has a picture of the Concorde on it, in which he writes his theories, most notably his theory of beauty. Even it seems that two other writers, both of them potentially dangerous Russians, are, it seems, enraged and maddened to the degree to which they betray their work and the dreams of their youth. So writing is presented here as safe.
Yes, here's an irony. Yes, if they just stayed within the boundaries of their story. But perhaps if writing is presented as safe, I think I'm also saying something else, just maybe in a kind of a bracket here, which is that writers, in order to have something to say, in order to, oh, I don't know, go beyond the boundaries of their known world. I mean, we as writers, we all think we do as much travelling as we can, but time is finite. You know, we can't know everything, so we have to send our imaginations as these kind of envoys, I think, to the most unlikely places. I'm a great truster in the imagination. I think it is a boundless thing. I think it does know no limits. And I've always sent mine out. If I haven't been able to send myself out on adventures, I've sent my imagination out on adventures. And these adventures may be perilous. If they're only imaginative adventures and they're perilous, then okay. But in fact, the actual adventures may be perilous. But I don't see writing per se as a perilous thing. I see writing, paradoxically, as where one returns after the adventures have occurred. So for me, I know this is a kind of a paradox, but the actual act of writing, provided the imagination has done its work or the self has been allowed to voyage wherever it needs to go and has survived the journey, the act of writing, provided it's honourable, is safe. I mean, here in this book we're getting into other moral questions about plagiarism and the reasons for which one does this activity in the first place. But it's the actual act of writing, which is done in a room like the one we're sitting in now, there is some certain safety in that.
Now, I wanted to talk to you relatedly about the design of books, because although this book is narrated by a 13-year-old boy, it is also written by Rose Tremaine, and the reader of the book sees, in retrospect, all sorts of beautiful lines of symmetry and shape and structure. And so we have the feeling behind the book of a lot of shaping and shifting. And I think it's crucial to this kind of book that it must give the hum of a world beyond itself where there are inner orders to be penetrated. Could you speak about how the book got built?
Just taking the idea of the voice first, the voice in which this story is told, which is, if you like, our access to it, our way into it, the way we find it. It seemed to me very important for this story that it be contained within Lewis's world. Therefore, I only give myself access to what Lewis thinks he can understand. At the same time, I also wish the reader to know that the events of the book and this sort of tangled web between lies and secrets and texts which may be borrowed or stolen or disappear is more complex, more difficult, mm-hmm. more outrageous mm-hmm. than he has the capacity to understand. But I think, and I don't think the reader understands it, of course, completely, because he is our only vehicle. But I think that the reader understands that his version of it isn't quite right, that it is more difficult than he imagines.
For instance, though, Didier, a roofer, and roofs will be crucial in the climax of this novel, tells a story about how his father died. This story has to do with roofs, balloons, birds, and the story will be repeated in the climax of the book, tragically. And we are going to have a narrator who likes to look at the sky after his set of events, and in a bit that really moved me, he writes a letter to someone he's met to ask about the sky where the other character is now. Now, this symmetry says something implicitly then about the world. If these events have slid into place in parallel, one is in a horrifyingly ordered world beyond one's nightmares.
I think really absolutely at the heart of this book, which following the progression of the way adolescence is like a kind of acceleration of life, like things suddenly moving like on a roller coaster too fast, so fast that you're kind of clinging on and you're sort of screaming and you're frightened. That the events of the book, the sort of turmoil of the book, gets faster and faster. And to underscore that, I wanted this sense of terror. Terror was an absolute key word. I started with these two key words, terror on the one hand and enchantment on the other. And of course, all great cities in whatever country contain a big element of both these things. I think this is why we're attracted to them. We're attracted equally to the terror as to the enchantment, and we expect to find an element of terror, perhaps not as much as Lewis finds, hopefully not, but then of course quite often we do. But the idea of vertigo, of being up high, looking down a sort of a dark well, or one could have any number of metaphors for what in fact is happening in the mind and what is actually happening physically to Lewis. This was always at the heart of this. And I couldn't precisely tell you when it came into the scheme of the novel, but it seems to me to have always been in place, and that the ending always had to do with falling. It always had to do with being, having the head somewhere else. We were talking earlier on about sort of being distracted, you know, by what's going on at your feet because you're so mesmerized by a particular thing. And I think this relates back to this, of having the head kind of metaphorically in the sky or turned away or turned upwards in a fatal way so that you don't understand where your body is placed or where what you should be anchored in, where it precisely it is rooted, and so you risk to fall. You risk to fall physically, actually, but you also risk to fall into a kind of despair or kind of darkness. And I wanted to have a lot of play on this idea of roofs and vertigo. I mean, I'll tell you in a bracket here that to write this novel, I spent a lot of time in Paris. I'm actually living there in 1994. And I'm not a great journal keeper, but I did keep a journal during these Paris months, and because it was very important to record everything that happened to me. And when I read through this journal, I see it's full of a kind of exhortations to myself to go and stand up on high buildings. And I am a person who suffers terribly from this vertigo. And so the doing of this, which I did as little as I possibly could, was an absolute agony. But it's that, my inability to do it myself, kind of reinforced my idea that this is how the reader should feel after a certain moment of this book has passed, that it would be exciting for the reader to feel in this sort of vertiginous state.
Yes, what I've noticed about narratives of this kind, and they are among my favorite, and it seems to me to be hard to do, is that the world has to be constructed according to causality, that is to say, the normal world, but also according to meaning, which is to say, the symbolic world. The meaningful world is full of arranged events that have symmetries and significances, but the causal world seeks to evade that. The character is trying to shimmy into meaning, almost as if to escape life, and then meaning virtually thrusts him back, as if once you have gained a glimpse of an order beyond your ken, you must be thrown out of that Eden and back into the narrow bump of the day-to-day world.
Yes.
And this seems to be represented in the book by two concepts of medieval time in Madame Valentina's book. And I wondered if you'd talk about that.
Yes, well, she discovers this, which seemed to me just metaphorically perfect for this story, that in the Middle Ages they measured the hours of the night in a different way. So they measured always 12 hours between sunrise and sunset, so that the hours of the night of the winter, of course, are extremely long. And then gradually they get shorter and shorter as the sun comes up. And actually, in terms of what she's trying to construct in her mystery romances, this forgetting about time proves fatal in one of her stories. And Lewis overhears this conversation about medieval time and how they measure time in the Middle Ages and is slightly baffled by it. And then he understands, and again I think we're back to what happens in adolescence, he understands that time is kind of going along differently in him. He says this in the first paragraph of the book, which is the last paragraph of the book in a sense, and the first and the last is a kind of framing on these events. And I think the reader clearly understands that although the events of the book take place in, say, 2.5 months, I can't quite remember how many weeks it is, but in the space of one summer, his internal time is extremely, extremely different. And that by the end of the story, he is no longer the same person, really. And he is thrown back into an understanding of these events that he would not have been capable of at the beginning.
In fact, what has, in a sense, literally happened in this book is that his father has built him a house to write a book in. He's written this book, and there he is, having retired from risk in the pleasures of reconstruction.
He suspects all along that this little house, this hut, which he is so mocking about, which the father is building, not for him, but for Alice. And he suspects, first of all, that it'll be a tragic-seeming place, that it won't look like the wonderful summer house his father hopes it to be, but it will look more like a sort of public toilet. he suspects all along that in order to sort of assuage his father's feelings of inadequacy, that he will be the one to inhabit it. And we think, well, this is extremely unlikely, but of course in the end he is.
I'm speaking to Rose Tremaine, the author most recently of The Way I Found Her. Really a magnificent book of enchantment and terror and the desire to find the exit from childhood, which may be the most difficult part of one's first 20 years nowadays. But I wanted to speak hypothetically or in some way to say that there is no book, I suspect, that has the emotional power and mystery that this one has, unless there are ghosts moving about in it, unless there is more than in fact meets the eye. And I found myself thinking as I read, I know that you are involved with the biographer Richard Holmes, and it struck me that in a way much of his work is concerned with tracing down mysterious persons from the past into the present. And so as I began to muse about the book, I thought of you looking at him as a child in Paris, and that what he's seeking is in some sense some version of you, so that the book has a kind of, to my mind,
sort of
circularity that keeps it cycling, that someone is looking for someone who is looking for her, and that this eternal circle gives the book its life. Does that make any kind of?
I think it's a wonderfully complex idea, and I will go away and digest it. I mean, I think two things about this. One is that my decision to go back and live with Paris for a few months in 1994 was made with Richard. So that, as the dedication implies, he was my navigator. He has a much greater sense of sort of spatial consciousness than I do. I get lost extremely quickly. I could get lost walking around this quad. You know, I'm easily physically lost, whereas Richard never is. He always knows where north is, for instance. So he, in many senses, he was sort of my navigator around what I needed to find in Paris. And I think that both Richard and I have ghosts of ourselves which exist somewhere in France. Perhaps some of them do exist in Paris. We both had early, quite meaningful experiences in Paris, and of course, because that city is so unchanged, or relatively unchanged, I mean, compared to a city like London, you can go and stand on, as indeed I did while I was there, on a street corner of the street where I used to live when I was a student there, and it is virtually unchanged, and the restaurant opposite that I could never afford to visit is still there. So, you know, you can go and find your own ghost, and maybe we were circling each other's ghosts in some way there. But I think there's another thing going on, which is beyond my very happy living experience with Richard Holmes, which is that writers, if, like me, they become ridiculously emotionally attached to the people that they're writing about. In Richard's case, of course, they are real people. In my case, they're entirely invented people. But there are those ghosts that are kind of lingering somewhere. There's always a sense that one has of the story being unfinished, so that the next book, although it may be a different time, a different place, different gender, different far in all senses from the previous one, I think there may be elements in it where the ghost of the previous book is still alive, that the ghost of little Mary Ward, who is a child endeavouring to become male through a very, very precarious and unhappy adolescence, is hovering around Lewis somewhere. She never goes to France, but nevertheless, I think in some of the language and in some of the confusions that Lewis feels, there's the ghost of Mary Ward, and perhaps when I was writing that, there was, I don't know, in the mother of Mary, Estelle, there was a ghost of one of the characters in Restoration who is incarcerated for madness. So that there is this kind of handing on from one book to the next, and it's been very interesting to me, having published this book simultaneously in Britain and in France, that the French critics have been much, much more perspicacious about seeing like a kind of relay baton in my work handed on from one book to the next, mm-hmm. and saying there are the territory is different each time, but there are these similarities which connect them all.
What I notice in particular, and that pleases me a lot, and I said this to Richard as well, is that a lot of the conversation at this symposium about contemporary British writing keeps circling around realism, and the ghost repeatedly invoked is the ghost of F.R. Leavis. Now, for an American, there's a dread of the great tradition. Mm. We kind of hate it. The last world we want to be consigned to when we read is the real world. We want the world of ghosts. Mm. And what I like about both of your work, in contradistinction to much contemporary British writing, is that the characters are haunted. They are on the verge of being shattered. There is a much more vulnerable level of experience that leads these characters to certain haunted states, it seems to me. And that's why, also, I think the book has the feeling of vistas of vulnerability that allow the reader to feel much greater compassion for the book itself, because the structure is itself vulnerable.
It's very important to me to make the reader feel. I'm not so interested in having the reader stand back at a kind of, I don't know, an arm's length, an emotional arm's length, and thinking, ah, oh, this is clever, or this is nifty, or this fits in with current literary theory about this or that. I'm not really interested in that. If one can pull off some clever stints, it's great. But, I mean, my primary aim as a writer is to immerse the reader in something which will have the illusion, anyway, for the time that he or she reads it, of being new, of being strange, of being disturbing, of maybe changing some assumptions that person has about the way life is constructed, but giving them some deep experience that lingers on.
I've been speaking to Rose Tremaine, the author most recently of The Way I Found Her, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Mark.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Podcast.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.